With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Seeking Witchcraft. I'm your host, Ashley, and today we're diving into a really timely and fascinating topic, which is the connection between witchcraft and politics, because witchcraft is political. Joining us is witch reverend and activist Ron Padron of White Rose Witching to discuss this topic. So Ron, thank you so much for returning again and for being here. And yeah, I'm so excited to have you back.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me back. This is, you know, I feel like it's always a timely topic to talk about sort of politics and witchcraft. I wish it was a less turbulent time to be talking about it, but
same.
But I think, you know, because of all that, I think it is a really necessary conversation. So I appreciate you having me back to have the conversation.
Oh, of course. And so for those who have not listened to your previous episode, could you start with just a little bit of background about yourself?
Yeah. So I am identify as a gay Cuban American, disabled, you know, first generation, hedge priest. My background is, so I'm ordained through Sacred Wall Congregation, hence the Reverend title. I've been a practicing pagan for, almost 20 years, maybe a little over 20 years at this point. Over the last decade or so, my practice has really started to dive more deeply into things like spiritual activism, centering my queerness. So it's been a real healing journey for myself. So queer-centered and queer-affirming spirituality, particularly around queer ancestor veneration, which is really how White Rose Witching got its start. And just more and more, just following that thread, especially that sort of queer ancestor legacy thread, has just led me more and more into that activist and advocacy space. And White Rose Witching is the vehicle or the container I use to kind of house all of those projects or all of those writings or workshops or things that I do.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. And again, as we mentioned earlier, Ron has previously been on the episode or on the podcast, and we talked a lot about queer witchcraft. And so if you're interested, you can find that in one of the episodes. So I guess to start, we're going to talk about witchcraft being political. So for those who have never heard this, how would you define what that means?
So we're starting with the simple big question.
The simple big question, exactly.
Yeah. I think there are lots of ways that you can approach that question, right? So I think we can take it from the purely historical lens about the idea of witchcraft being political and look at sort of the centuries long history of the persecution of people that were identified or believed to be witches, or witchcraft was used as an excuse to oppress, exterminate, them or confiscate their properties or their belongings. And I'm using witchcraft in a pretty big umbrella term in that approach to it, because yes, there are sort of like the Salem witch trial stuff, or the witch hunts in Scotland, or the witch craze in Europe. There's all that, but I'm also using it as this umbrella term of like anything that is not sanctioned sort of magic or spirituality. And by that, I mean sort of sanctioned by the Christian church or Western European imperialism as far as the proper way to be spiritual, to be faithful. And so that also gets into the whole conversation of colonization and conquest and the erasure of indigenous communities and their cultures and their ways of being. and the forced conversion of those communities into, you know, whatever particular flavor of Christianity their conquerors or their captors were practicing. So there's that historical lens to it, where it's always been a tool of, it's always been used as an excuse to implement the exercise of control of power against marginalized subgroups, while also on the flip side to that, it's also been a tool of those marginalized subgroups to try to influence the world around them or to seek justice on their own. You know, the one thing I always point to is, and this is not necessarily something that is central to my particular practice, but Aradia in The Gospel of the Witches, you know, she talks about, like, the opening sort of read to it talks about how she was sent down to teach the oppressed how to break their chains and poison the oppressors. And so there's also this inherent sort of tie between witchcraft as a tool for those who don't have access to maybe the direct levers of power to get justice or to protect themselves against people or systems that are otherwise stacked against them.
I love that you reference that book, because a lot of people will think of, like, hexing, for example, or doing negative types of magic, whatever they might define it as. And there's this whole big movement online of, like, no, you shouldn't do things like that. You shouldn't do this, like, darker magic. But then if you read Aradia, Gospel of the Witches, you know, the book is pretty much like, hey, we're going to fuck up your oppressors. So that way things can be a little bit more even here. So I love that you referenced that. I was actually going to kind of ask a similar question of just your thoughts of, like, we've seen movements of, like, hexing the patriarchy. I feel like that was, like, really popular during COVID times, when Trump was initially president. What do you think draws people towards magical activism today?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think part of it is magical activism is a way to operate outside of sort of the prescribed lanes or boundaries that, you know, folks want us to kind of stay within. So I think magical activism is a way that we engage in sort of direct power, direct activism. I'm stumbling over my words a little bit because I think, like, two particular sorts of answers want to come out. One is that from sort of like a cultural anthropological lens, folks historically have kind of gravitated towards witchcraft and something that we would identify as witchcraft or magic or something like that when they feel like it is the means to an end for them to achieve justice, whatever that's a big justice, like, you know, getting revenge or getting vengeance or getting justice for the death of a family member or something like that. Or sort of small sort of acts of justice, like somebody slighted you, like, socially, and so you're trying to kind of get back at them in that sense. So very different sorts of scales of things. But I also think it's important to note that, and we've seen this in the United States at least, for at least the majority of my life, the far right, especially the religious right, has talked about their experiences in the United States and their sort of movements to kind of recapture the government and the culture and all this sort of stuff as part of a spiritual war and part of spiritual warfare. And so I think from that lens, then I think folks are drawn to magical activism because either they are intuiting or understanding things on that same level, or they're kind of meeting their opponent, for lack of a better word, where they are on that level and saying, okay, so if this is also something that's happening, not just in the what's happening in the courtroom or what's happening as far as sort of my civil rights or civil liberties are concerned, but also this sort of spiritual level, the spiritual plane, then that means that I also need to be engaging at that level too. And so I think, especially with the rise of Christian nationalism, a lot of that has taken sort of center stage in the last several years, especially since the first Trump term. And so I think there's been an increased, I don't want to say an increased draw to magical activism, but those of us who do spiritual activism from a non-Christian lens or a non-Christian approach, I think have just become more vocal or more centered in certain conversations. And so folks are seeing that they have options available to them where maybe they didn't think there were before.
Yeah. So on that topic of religion, I was going to ask how you think witchcraft intersects with religious freedoms and rights in our current political climate. I mean, you know, we talked a lot about Christian nationalism. I know most recently there was an order that was anti-Christian, bias was not allowed. But I have found that there's been more bias towards my religion as a pagan. So I found that order to be very interestingly worded. Yeah. It's been an interesting time for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's really interesting too. So yeah, so that order that came out of the Attorney General's office about creating that task force for rooting out anti-Christian bias in the federal workforce. I think multiple agencies got the memo. I think the memo that was leaked was specifically from the VA, you know, but they set up a snitch line for that. You know, it's really interesting that you have that particular movement to kind of play into that Christian persecution sort of mythology that motivates the far right, especially the Christian nationalist right. While at the same time, was it yesterday? That Reverend William Barber, who is a very well-known Christian leader, he is involved with the Poor People's Campaign, and you know he's been an active voice for progressive policy and cultural change in the country, specifically lifting up the needs of the marginalized and the working poor. He was arrested for leading a small prayer group in the Capitol Rotunda. I think it was yesterday. It might have been earlier today. And so also, you know, so even within this lens of like anti-Christian bias, you have a Christian pastor leading Christian prayer in the Capitol Rotunda that just happens to be, you know, the message of that prayer, the message of his movement that is informed by his understanding of the same Bible, the same sort of gospel and dogma that is also motivating Christian nationalism. Was arrested. So I just, you know, so when you talk about how does the current moment play into, you know, witchcraft or paganism or what have you, I mean, it's a dangerous time. I mean, they're literally eating their own, you know, turning against anybody who has a differing idea of Christianity that runs counter to the prevailing narrative, a sort of propagandized version of sort of American prosperity gospel, white supremacy, you know, with a cross on it, approach to Christianity. So when they're coming for their own, when they're coming for people that are ostensibly even within the same sort of like sandbox as them, then obviously people that are outside of that sandbox are at a much, much higher level of danger. We've seen kind of the temperature being ratcheted up over the last couple of years. You know, it wasn't too long ago, I think it was last year, that there was a shop in Pennsylvania where somebody who was doing tarot readings was being harassed by the police. Earlier this year, a shop in North Carolina was getting harassed by local sort of right-wing extremists, also in Orlando, Florida, a long time, a pagan shop that's been there for a long, long time, had some extremists from outside of Orlando, I believe. I think they're from somewhere else in Florida, come and sort of harass people going into their shop, sort of picket or boycott outside of the shop. So we've seen an increase in this sort of activity just in the last few years. But for those of us, like, so I grew up in the South. And so I think for some of us, we're just, you know, who grew up in this sort of milieu of we can see what's coming and we're like, yeah, no, it's going to be a dangerous time to be openly identified, depending on where you are. I happen to live in sort of like an urban area now. So I live in a much more sort of metropolitan, cosmopolitan place. And so personally, I feel like I can leave my house and do the sort of activism and spiritual work that I do in the area that I live in, like with no problem right now. But I definitely know that there are places that folks are reconsidering how much they are advertising their own spiritual beliefs or their own spiritual practice. And folks might question, like, well, why do they have to advertise that? You know, that whole refrain of just like, stop shoving down my throats. But I'm talking about stuff as simple as like wearing a pentacle or wearing, wearing a medallion with like the symbol of Yahweh on it. where folks don't blink twice about leaving their house wearing a cross or something like that, you know, we're in a place now where, depending on where you live, it has become much more dicey to even leave your house wearing the wrong type of shirt.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I will identify and say that I live right outside of Washington, D.C., and I have lived in my state for my entire life. And this is a very Democratic blue state. However, given the shifts of politics within this last year, it's definitely been different outside, I feel like. I think more of like an influx of people coming in with differing ideologies. It's also important to note that as somebody who lives in an area right outside the governor, right outside of DC, I personally have a lot of people that I know who work in the government. I myself am tied not directly into the government, but I work with the government in some capacity. I've had family that have worked in the government for almost 40 years. And this is just a wild time. There's a lot of things that I have seen from friends or family, emails that have gone out that sometimes don't even make it to the news because there's just something new every single day going out there. So yeah, it's been quite a wild time, very much a changing landscape. I still feel comfortable wearing my pentacle outside, but I also am very aware of how different it feels out here now. And it's been quite a scary time, quite honestly. So yeah.
Yeah. And that I think it's often attributed to Mark Twain, which I think people don't necessarily know where it came from, but they attribute it to him. But yeah, that saying of history doesn't often repeat, but it does rhyme. We've seen stuff like this before. So especially if you think about like in the 1950s with McCarthyism and the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare, you know, I don't think folks, I will also name that I also live outside of DC now. So I've been here for about 13 years. And I don't think folks truly understand the scope of the type of, I honestly can't use a word other than inquisition, that is happening within the federal government. That's on par with this stuff that like most folks hold up as like, wow, that was a dark time in the United States as far as how we were treating people and persecuting people for having different beliefs in the government, where folks are being accused of being communist or being accused of being gay or being all this sort of stuff. And it was used to kind of ferret them out, get them fired, get them out of federal jobs or government jobs, even if it was just like basic jobs. Like Frank Kameny, who is I have a Queer Ancestor Spotlight about Frank Kameny on my blog. There's a great book by Dr. Eric Cervini called The Deviance War, if you want to read about this particular time in history from a queer liberation standpoint. But he was sort of like one of the early movement leaders in queer liberation pre-Stonewall in DC. And he started his whole thing because he was found out for being gay and wouldn't lie about it. Wasn't going to be like, oh no, I'm not. But he worked for the Geographic Service, I think. Like he did something around cartography. So he like did a job that was like just like a desk job sort of situation. But they were like, no, you're gay, so you can't be in the government anymore. And he lost his job. And the whole mentality was oh well, because since you're gay, that means that you're liable to be blackmailed, without processing the fact of like, well, the only reason that you're even potentially making them that blackmailable is because you have decided that they have to lie about being gay. And instead of, I understand the cultural context of the time, whatever, but there's a lot of similarities to moments in time like that in our country where there are folks who are career civil servants where their whole life, like they just are doing the basic job, you know, that happens sort of behind the scenes that helps to keep the government running, that now they're at risk because they posted the wrong thing on Facebook, or they happen to, you know, again, with this anti-Christian bias thing, they happen to interpret their religious teachings a different way than the regime. You know, when they first announced the thing about the anti-Christian bias thing with the snitch line, I was like, well, I really hope a lot of people in the VA will start reporting all of the instances where they've been unable to help the sick or help the poor or like anything that, like, you know, and I grew up Roman Catholic. So like anything that like Jesus actually talked about, like all the times that they've been unable to do that, I hope they report that to the anti-Christian bias line. We know that's not what that bias line is for. But yeah, so it's a uniquely sort of scary time. And I think something about our geographic proximity to it, I mean, I don't know about you, but I definitely feel like psychically, there's something in the air that makes it kind of so difficult to be so close to like the epicenter of where everything is.
Yeah, it's definitely not a fun time right now. I've been in a lot of meetings with government clients where people have been crying at the end of the calls, myself included tearing up because of the depth of how things are going now in like the scientific communities and such. But anyway, I feel like we can talk all day about the injustices and inequalities and all the things that are happening in our government right now, which is kind of related to this episode. But yes, I can agree with you. It is quite a rough time right now. But I will add one thing. I thought it was very interesting that there's a whole order about anti-Christian bias now, when if you look at the major holidays that people have off for the federal workforce, or just, I don't know, most of the US in general, it's all Christian holidays. So, you know, I don't get off for the winter solstice that day, or I don't get off for Beltane or like any of the other, I don't want to say big of the pagan holidays, but you know, like the heavy hitter, like the ones everybody knows. I don't get those days off, but sure, you know, I guess Christmas is fine. I mean, even Jewish populations, they don't get a lot of their, actually, I don't think they get any major holidays off either. It is all based around the Christian calendar. So, just
yeah, I mean, for a little
caveat.
Yeah, Jewish holidays. Muslim
they might
holidays,
be listed on the calendar.
Yeah, and like at least like in education or in certain places, like there's understands or caveats of just like, oh, okay, we'll make accommodations for this, but they're not, you know, they're not a given. They're not national holidays or everything's shut down. You know, you don't the default when you go, like I was recently, you know, going to the grocery store for something a couple weeks ago, and there are the signs saying that, you know, they're going to be closed for Easter. You know, the every president that we've had has been some sort of Christian. You know, the majority members of Congress are some sort of Christian. Like the history of this country up until the present, and including the present, is that all of the people who have been in positions of power and authority have been some flavor of Christian, and usually a white guy. So yeah, so just the we all, I mean, I keep saying we all know, maybe I shouldn't say that, and I should actually like state it out loud, but the whole thing about anti-Christian bias is just to allow further discrimination on LGBTQ plus communities, disabled communities, women, especially women looking for access to reproductive or reproductive health care. So all of these things under the guise of quote unquote religious freedom, which, you know, again, kind of sort of bringing it back to this idea of witchcraft and political, a lot of modern interpretations or modern conceptions of witchcraft or things that show up in paganism are these things that are deeply rooted in the idea of personal sovereignty of sort of folks. You know, you see this in our approach to even how we discuss spirituality, like paganism writ large is yes, there are particular traditions or paths or things that you might follow, but in the last 15, 20 years or so, you know, there's been that rise in really trying to make room for that unverified personal gnosis. And so understanding that people's relationship to their own particular witchcraft, their own particular paganism, their own particular spirituality is something that is personal, that their relationship to their gods or their spirits or their ancestors or the spirits of the land is a personal relationship that while we could have a shared consensus sort of framing around how we might discuss this or the type of language you might use in our particular cosmologies, it still is deeply rooted in personal ecstatic experience, in personal relationship, and in personal growth. And that emphasis on personhood, that emphasis on the individual is at odds with things when it comes into connection with, you know, who do I have the right to marry, or who do I have the right to love or hook up with, or, you know, I'm not somebody, I'm a cisgendered man. I was, you know, assigned male at birth, and that's the gender that I identify with. So, you know, this doesn't impact me necessarily, especially I'm a gay man, so I'm as far removed from it as you could probably be. But for folks who are capable of getting pregnant, you know, this runs squarely into that level of personal autonomy and agency, especially when you even consider that, you know, outside of even some Christian groups interpreted this way, but outside of Christianity, some Jewish interpretations of their religion or what have you, there are religious interpretations that say, no, we value the life of the mother utmost. Like, that is central to that. Or we don't view, a fetus or whatever as a person until it's born and has taken its first breath. So, like, even when you come to things like sort of reproductive justice or access to abortion, there's all these sorts of conflicting, or not conflicting, but like different ways of approaching it from a spiritually centered lens, that this idea of anti-Christian bias is really just figuring out how do we center this far-right Christian nationalist approach to viewing the world. And anytime anybody at any level doesn't get to say no, then that's an example of quote-unquote bias.
I can't wait for the day where we get to experience having our first Jewish president, our first Hindu president. This unfortunately will probably be long past my life, but man, I'm looking for some diversity. Oh, but I forgot that's a bad word, but diversity. Sorry, I'm going on a soapbox here.
Yeah, I mean, just look at what happened when we elected our first Black president. Like, they everybody just completely lost their minds, and we're, you know, you can't say that we're not where we are right now because of a racial backlash, at least in part. So yeah, I can't imagine what would happen after we got our first Jewish president, or especially just considering how much of like the far right and even Christian nationalism, all this sort of stuff is motivated by anti-Semitism or this like Christian Zionist approach to, they need Israel to exist to fulfill the end times prophecy. If there's one thing that you take away from this podcast episode with me, it should be that we probably shouldn't put people who actively want to see the end of the world happen in their lifetime in charge of things. And yeah, so I can't imagine what the backlash would be for a Jewish president or a Muslim president, or God forbid, like a pagan president. Like, I think they would just burn everything down.
I mean, our country wanted to nearly impeach Obama for wearing a tan suit at one point. So let's not forget about that. I think it was called like Tan Suit Gate or something. It was like a whole thing.
I can't. There's just too many.
Anywho. Okay. Well, getting back to our conversation, actually, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back in a moment to continue discussing witchcraft as political. So stay tuned. Okay. And we're back. So, Ron, let me ask you, what role do you think that social media and online communities play in political witchcraft, I guess I should say?
Yeah. Oh, man. That, you know, honestly, I think my answer depends on the day. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, this is great. And then sometimes I'm like, oh, this is going to kill us all. But I think ultimately my experience has been that, especially lately, is that social media has been a great way for those of us who feel called to engage in spiritual activism or understand sort of the political reality of witchcraft and how witchcraft can be used as a political tool. It's allowed us to find each other and create communities where we can better organize, share resources, strategize, that sort of stuff. So I'm not talking about just kind of joining like a random totally public Facebook group or things like that. I'm talking about intentionally built community, whether it's on Signal or Discord, or, I mean, it could be on Facebook, it could be a Facebook group, Reddit, any of the various sort of social media platforms that kind of took off after Twitter started to really started to implode. So I think approach from a very intentional perspective of understanding that social media is a tool and not a reality, even though that is what social media wants to be. That's what the social media sort of oligarchs want it to be. They want it to be sort of our new, you know, they talk about it being the new public square, but they also just want it to be the new reality that we engage in. If you understand that it's not, and that it is a tool to help us be more intentional about how we connect with folks and allows us to connect with people that, you know, the beauty of it is that we can connect with people all around the world. And for some folks who, for some witches or pagans where they might be one of a handful in their community, you know, this could be a lifeline for them. It could be a lifesaver. So I think there's a lot of benefit in that. I think we are not immune from propaganda. We are not all perfectly media literate or information literate. So I do think we have an obligation to make sure that we are approaching this, you know, especially in light of like things like Marco Rubio closing the arm of the Department of State that combats foreign misinformation and disinformation, right? Like we all have a heightened responsibility to become better consumers of information and media. But I think it can serve a vital role because things that, you know, in my own personal experience, things that if I'm struggling to figure out how to approach something, I can tap into a network of folks in New England or in the Midwest or the UK or in Spain that are doing similar work or have done work that has been successful or has done work that has not been successful and then be like, okay, we tried this. If we were going to do it again, this is how we would approach it, or like maybe don't do this. So it can help inform us and help us better kind of strategize and figure out how to do things. Also, in instances where we really need to be doing sort of ritual at a grander scale or a mass scale, it's really helpful to help us coordinate that and make that happen. In the lead up to the election, for example, I was running something in a closed group that was inspired by Dion Fortune's magical, there's a book, Magical Battle, A Battle of Britain, that is a collection of Dion Fortune's letters that the organization that she was with, I'm blanking on their name, they were meeting weekly and then monthly to perform sort of magical visualization activities to help strengthen the morale of the UK and to help defend in a spiritual way the UK from the Nazis. And so I used that as a template for a series of weekly visualizations that happened for about 5 months that were focused on sort of not necessarily like winning the election or anything, but focused on increased civic engagement, increased commitment to sort of democratic ideals, those sorts of things. The postmortem of it, we were all kind of looked at it. We're like, did, you know, where did this work? How did it work? So there's, you know, a lot of dissecting to do, but that was only able to be accomplished at the scale it happened at because of leveraging social media or the internet in general. This instance, it happened to be sort of a closed forum. But yeah, so I mean, I think it could be a real benefit, but it's also super, super tricky.
How do you respond to people who say that or criticize that witchcraft activism is more symbolic rather than effective?
I mean, okay.
that's a fair, honestly, fair response.
I mean, there's so much that we do that is symbolic. Like there's so much that we do that is, you know, that gets construed as performative. And I'm not talking about like performative. Like I feel like there are certain words that have lost their meaning because of spaces like Twitter threads or whatever. And we throw things around like, well, that's just performative. It's like, okay, yeah, like the point of something being a performance is to draw attention to it. And that might be the point. In the early 90s, ACT UP, which was an organization that was trying to draw attention to the queer community dying of AIDS at the hands of absolute government abandonment and neglect, staged they were infamous for a number of sort of like directly disruptive performances. They staged like a die-in at St. Patrick's Cathedral. They did the Ashes Action March, where they marched on the White House lawn with the ashes of people who have died from AIDS and dumped the ashes on the lawn, like over the fence. You know, all of those activities, like no single one of those activities or those things did like, you know, they didn't do the tie-in at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and suddenly people were just like, oh my God, like, we should actually take this seriously and fund AIDS research and understand that our approach to just quarantining gay men with AIDS and letting them die on their own, like, is inhumane. And we should actually care for these people and provide them medical care and assistance and palliative care and all that. Like, no single one of those things was the thing that changed the cultural temperature or changed policy. All of those things served to make sure that the spotlight or the media coverage or what have you never left from that conversation. So some things are just performative because their role is to be a performance that keeps the attention on something. And that is totally fine.
Yeah, I was going to add something too, where, well, one, people are always complaining on the internet. Going back to the original question, always criticizing. Not always, but the internet's for the internet, you know. I want to bring up this concept. I think I actually talked about this on a previous episode, but I've heard people asking or saying things like, oh, well, you know, if witches are real, if witchcraft and magic is real, how come, like, you guys can't do any magic towards the president? Or doesn't even have to be the president, be any sort of, like, big political figure or even, like, actor, actress, anything like that. Somebody who's very famous. And a lot of times the very simple answer to that is because there could be 100 witches doing a working towards a famous political figure. There could be 10,000 religious people praying for that person. So it's kind of like this back and forth where a lot of times people are protected, whether you want to believe that or not. And I'm not saying that one deity is stronger than the other, but what I am saying is there are people who dedicate their entire lives to praying for some of these famous people from the moment they wake up to the moment they go to bed for many, many years now. The average witch probably has other things they're doing with their life aside from that.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I'm 40, so I'm of that age that, you know, maybe I didn't, maybe it was people who were a little bit younger than me, kind of grew up. We were just inundated with, because, you know, if you're an elder millennial or younger, you grew up in an era where you were inundated with levels of media that were just unfathomable to people who came before us. So we were inundated with books and TV shows and movies and stuff like that about, like, that YA dystopia stuff, but like Hunger Games or Percy Jackson or, you know, stuff like that, where there's, you know, I think to a certain extent, we're all waiting around for, like, that plucky, you know, teenager who's the chosen one, who's going to, like, topple everything and save us. And it's like, that's not how it works. And to your point, where it's just like, you know, people were just like, I'm going to take up witchcraft, or I'm going to take up, you know, XYZ thing, and I'm going to cast a spell to topple the patriarchy or to abolish ICE or whatever it might be. And then you do it. And then, like, it's like, first off, that's not how magic happens. And partly because, and again, I grew up Catholic, and so there's still parts of my practice that are very folk Catholic. But something that I have kept from that time is the, I think it was, I forgot what gospel it was in, but this notion of, like, faith without works is dead, where it's like, you do the magic and then you do the thing, like, to help make the magic happen. Like, the magic might help clear a path and you follow that path to do the thing, or the magic needs you to help move some stuff out of the way so it can be as effective as possible. So magic is not this, it is not a silver bullet. It is something that requires your active participation in. But also, yeah, like, there are people who have been, like, this particular moment in time is something that the far right has been strategizing for, moving pieces around the board for, to make it possible for the last 50 years. So, you know, so yes, there are people who have been actively praying for this to happen. There are people, like, So like, it's not just a, okay, we're going to rally and now it's, you know, the third act in the movie and now we're suddenly triumphant. It's no, there is no roll credits in reality. It's this constant sort of unveiling of just, like, stuff of just shit that's happening. And so we're in a moment right now where it's like, okay, well, these people, you know, I'm going to be very honest with you. These people won. That, like, Christian nationalism has won. They spent the last 50 years, if not longer, making it possible to have this moment, and they won. And so we are up against people that have had 50 plus years of strategizing and figuring out how they're going to make this happen. Now, to their credit, they gave us their 900-page playbook last year, and too many people said, no, they're never going to do that. But that's what they're implementing. So we have to be realistic in the fact of just like, yeah, there are people who actively want this to happen. There are people who are creating a cone of protection around all this sort of stuff that's happening, because call it magic, call it prayer, call it whatever. It's all the same thing. And so there are people who are spiritually reinforcing what is happening because they want it to happen. And so we also have to understand that it will take spiritual momentum from our side to sort of help to overcome that or push back on it in any meaningful way. That's not to be defeatist. That's not to say that we shouldn't try. When people ask, well, what should I do to figure out how do I use my witchcraft in the moment to kind of push back against stuff? My first go-to thing is divination. There was a cartoon when I was little, I can't remember what it was. I think it was Secret Squirrel. I was very little. And he was trying to find this one dude, this like one bad guy that was collapsing buildings or collapsing a whole bunch of stuff, because he would just go to a building and find the one brick that was like, if he stole this brick, it would make the whole building collapse. And so use divination. Figure out what is the one brick that you can focus on that will actually do something to kind of make that structure more susceptible to other people doing workings against it, or to other, maybe if you're attacking sort of like spiritually attacking ice or things like that, make it so that it's easier for people to kind of get away from them. You know, divination is that tool, because everybody wants to swing for the top, and it's like that is probably the most protected part that you could go for. Divination is going to help you figure out where your talents, or the talents of you and whatever group you might be working with, most effective. And it might be in places that are surprising to you. You might go, oh, I never thought that maybe, I'm not saying that witchcraft or anything had anything to do with like signal gate or whatever, but you know, it's that sort of stuff where it's just like, oh, wow, I never would have thought that like maybe doing some working to make sure that some dude who has no tech literacy accidentally adds a journalist to a signal chat. But like stuff like that, like that's the type of stuff that I think we witches and stuff like that, that's the space in which we work best of yeah, this is where we can make stuff happen.
For those who are engaging in this type of magic, how would you recommend for witches to protect their energy during emotionally exhausting political work?
I think this goes to everybody, just not just witches and stuff like that. But I think part of it is you don't have to be on all the time. So have, you know, set up whatever your space is. My house is really well warded. My house is really well grounded. It is a space that I am intentional about co-creating with my husband, a space that is regenerative and a place that I want to be. So that way, you know, if I need to unplug, then I'm in a space where I feel like I can recharge. And I think this also just goes the same for anybody kind of doing sort of social justice work, is you don't have to do it all on your own. You don't have to, and it's okay to say, I'm exhausted and I need to sit down, I need to tap out, or to shift strategies. Not everybody is meant to be sort of a frontline, like on the street marching sort of person. Maybe you are for a while, or maybe you are for a particular movement, but maybe in other spaces you're gathering information and sharing information with people. Maybe in your sort of online space, you're the person who is following what's happening with some of these executive orders and actually helping people understand what they're actually saying. So I think being aware that there's multiple ways that you can be engaged in activism or advocacy, and finding what is best for you in the moment. And also understanding that rest is resistance. And part of what fascism wants is to overwhelm you, to make you feel exhausted and tired and just totally brain fogged, so you can't actually figure out what's going on. And so in your, when you're in that space, you are a tool of fascism, and you are not, you're not useful to anybody other than them. And so doing what you need to do to kind of stay out of that space. So if that is having a grounding practice or a meditative practice, you know, whatever you might already have incorporated into your spiritual practice or your witchcraft for that, if you engage in things like cord cutting to kind of, as you're going throughout the day, just any sort of energetic gunk that you attract or what have you, cord cutting is a great practice to help kind of get that off of you. So what do you have in your particular, you know, witchy toolbox that helps you ground and helps you kind of keep that energetic or spiritual gunk off of you? And then what are you doing to kind of create the place where, whether it's your home or the room that you rent or whatever, a place that is safe and secure, so that way you're not always having to be quote unquote on guard, that you're like, okay, I can be in my house and kind of take a breath and know that the shielding around my house, my spiritual allies that are looking over my house, whatever it might be, they're protecting me right now. So that way I can be, you know, like unclench my jaw, relax my shoulders, take a deep breath, sort of thing.
Yeah. I love you mentioning that we shouldn't always be on. Sometimes, especially during very politically charged times in our society, it's hard to remember to fill your own cup first and make sure that you are able to ground yourself and be clear and protect your energy before you are expelling energy towards any causes that you might be engaging in. So I agree with everything that you said. And yeah, be careful out there, guys. Fill your own cup, you know, make sure you're okay, and look out for each other.
Yeah. And more like more active role sort of stuff, right? Like, you know, deities that you might work with or whatever that might be able to help, you know, whether it's like working with deities or glamours or all these sorts of things that you can do to kind of help protect and shield yourself while you're out there also doing the work, right? So I think they're one of the benefits of being witches is that we, and I will say I take a relational approach to witchcraft. So I look at how am I in relationship with the land around me, or for example, or queer ancestors in my particular practice. And so one of the benefits is that we are in relationship with much more than just the seen world. And that is a strength for us. And we can use that to help us when we are doing things that are more direct action, whether to help protect us, help kind of obscure the work that we're doing maybe, or help kind of make sure that the message that we are trying to relay is going further than it otherwise would.
Absolutely. Well, as we are getting towards the end here, Ron, I want to ask, do you know if there are any resources or books or any particular communities you'd recommend for listeners interested in learning more about this and trying to get their boots on the ground?
Yeah, so there's tons of stuff. I would say, so David Salisbury has a really great book. It came out, oh man, time is a strange concept now. I don't remember how long ago it came out, not too long, called Witchcraft Activism, that has a lot of really practical advice on not just how to engage in sort of activism with things like whether it's marching or letter writing or what have you, but also how to incorporate witchcraft into that. So I think that is a great book for people to pick up and start with. Also, Laura Tempest Zakroff is the kind of started the We Are Aradia movement over the last several years. And that has it picked up with, in the first Trump administration, the book, The New Aradia, which is a collection of essays, rituals, sigils written by a number of magical practitioners and activists, and since has grown into a series of books. There are three. There's New Aradia, Gorgon's Guide to Magical Resistance, I think it's called. And then the most recent one, Serpents of Circe, a manual for magical resilience, which I had the honor of co-editing with Laura, Serpents of Circe. So those three books, those are great. The first two are definitely more sort of direct action stuff. The third book is more around building magical resilience. So how do you build resilient communities? How do you, to kind of quote what you just said, how do you make sure that you're filling your own cup? And so those three books I think are really great to kind of get inspiration from. But there are lots and lots of amazing people out there kind of doing activist work, and from a witchcraft or a pagan centered perspective. I know John Beckett has been doing a lot of writing from his recently from his perspective around meeting the moment as an open pagan. So, and I find his writing to be very accessible. And yeah, I think those are some places that I'd maybe start. I will also say that the We Are Aradia series, the new Aradia series, those three books do intentionally, we go out of our way to highlight queer, BIPOC, disabled, voices. And so if you're looking for writings from people who are themselves living at the margins because of their identities or the intersections of their identities, I would recommend those books because it's their anthology, so they have lots of contributors. Then you can also just find tons of people that you can go find more of their writings or go follow them on social media.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. And before I ask for your information, I always ask somebody at the end of the episode, if you had one piece of advice to give a beginner, what would that piece of advice be?
The first thing that comes to mind is that when you're picking up your first book and it has the ritual outlines and things like that, you don't need to stick to that. Those are great examples. Those are great ways to kind of give you a framework in which to play with, but you're going to find your best magic when you allow yourself to improvise, especially if in the course of like you following sort of a ritual that's in a book you're reading, if you hit a part where you're like, it just kind of feels like sandpaper to you, then if you're forcing yourself to go through it, you're not doing effective magic. So allow yourself to kind of take these things as inspiration, as guides, but also then allow yourself to be creative and follow what feels natural for you. Because when you can kind of just do it in a natural flow state, that's where you're going to be your most powerful and your most successful in your magic.
I love that. That's fantastic advice. Thank you. I would definitely agree with that. I think it's good to use certain books or whatever you might get some material from as a guide, but really tailoring it and making it your own and doing what feels natural. I agree. That could be a really great way to get more in tune with what you're really trying to tap into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Ron, so much for coming on. For the listeners who want to get in contact with you, where could they find you?
Yeah. So probably the easiest place is my website, whiterosewitching.com. I'm also more active on Instagram. That's the social that I'm probably the most active on from like a witchy perspective. I am on Threads and Blue Sky. You can find all of this through my website as well. Threads and Blue Sky tends to be where I scream about politics the most. So I guess if you liked this episode and you want more of that, you can follow me there. And I also, at the beginning of this year, I started a Patreon. You can get to that through my website as well. The Patreon is designed to provide a deeper dive into spiritual activism and pagan liberation theology. So living your life through a pagan lens in a way that is focused on sort of personal, but also mutual liberation and a deeper dive into sort of queer ancestor work. And something that's a Patreon exclusive is divination through bone casting. So there's a bunch of different tiers on my Patreon. So if you just want to support at a level where you get access to like video essays or more ritual write-ups around spiritual activism, you can definitely do that. If you want access to one-on-one bone castings, that's at the top tier, you can definitely do that. But yeah. So I would say my website, though, is the easiest place to kind of go see where everything is.
And I will have a link to that in the episode description. And if anybody is interested in connecting with me, you can find me on Instagram at Seeking Witchcraft, on Facebook at Seeking Witchcraft Podcast. And I also have a Patreon if you're interested in supporting the show and getting some behind the scene looks and some heads up for when we have new episodes coming and joining our Discord and book club. You can find me on patreon.com/seekingwitchcraft. Well, thank you again, Ron, so much for coming on. This is such a pleasure. I was so happy to be able to talk about politics, especially in this very changing landscape that we are currently living through. And yeah, I really appreciate the conversation. And I hope that people listening to this could really get something from this episode and maybe feel a little bit more inspired to be a little bit more active if that is something they've been wanting to try out.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm excited to go back and listen to this to clock all the times where we had to consciously rein ourselves in and be like, okay, that's not what we're talking about. We got to bring it back here. Cause there were literally so many off ramps where we could have just dove into something else for another hour that was still talking about politics.
Oh yeah. I considering everything going on, I think we did good.
Yeah, I think we did good. So I hope the listeners enjoy it. I think this is a good episode.
Exactly. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and talk to you next time. Bye.